Good morning. You are listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in the big chair, coming to you live from Studio 2 at WJCT. Today, advocacy groups are using the legal system to push back on a spate of legislation in Florida that many are calling anti-LGBTQIA. And the Project Cold Case has a new edition of playing cards. Then, how the new Holocaust exhibit at the Jacksonville Public Library challenges assumptions. Plus, a preview of JME's 904 Souls Showcase. We've got a full show for you. So sit back, strap in, and let's get to it. Governor Ron DeSantis signed off on several bills in May, curtailing the rights of LGBTQ plus people and removing protections from vulnerable groups in Florida. The education and healthcare sectors have been significantly impacted by these new laws, and advocacy groups are challenging their legality by filing suits. We've got Jody Siegel, the executive director of the Southern Legal Council, on the phone, and Simone Chris, the director of transgender rights and the initiative at the Southern Legal Council. They've been working on these issues, and they join us now. You can join the conversation, too, by calling in at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air, First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, and you can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Jody Siegel, executive director, and Simone Chris, the director of transgender rights and initiative at the Southern Legal Council. Thank you so much for joining us today. How you doing?
Great. Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
So, yes, thank you so much.
Jody, can you just kind of give me the groundwork about like what the organization is and how it came into being?
Sure. We're based in Gainesville, but we're a statewide organization, which means we do work and advocate all around the state. We do quite a bit in Northeast Florida, and our mission is really to use the power of the law to obtain positive social change, reform systems and institutions. We try to strike down unjust laws and policies and hold government accountable. So we represent individuals with the goal of fixing the underlying problem, not only for our clients, but also for others who have experienced the same. At the moment, and we, over the years, we started actually as an outgrowth out of the University of Florida Law School. It was a research project, and then when it got to possible litigation, the law school said, you know, you really should be an independent organization, not the law school litigating, and so it started in 1977. And since then, we've focused on quite a few different issues. Right now, we do a lot of special education, representing children in trying to get the services that they need to blossom and become the people that they should be, in independent adults. We also represent homeless people to compel governments to seek solutions to end homelessness rather than just jail them. And then we also have a large portion, which is what we're here today to talk about. We represent LGBTQ people, issues, and try to, again, hold government accountable, have children have safe and affirming environments in school. And that's what, unfortunately, has become such a primary issue today with the, all of the new laws that have been passed by the government and the targeting of these people. And Simone has been doing an incredible job trying to hold the government accountable again. So that's what we do.
Simone, can you, give me a little bit of a rundown for our listeners about all of these laws that have come in ever since DeSantis became governor? There seems to be a push to take away protections from the LGBTQIA community. Can you talk through that with us? Like, what are these laws? When did they come about, and how are they affecting people?
Yeah, thank you so much. Really, you know, throughout this administration, we've seen really targeted attacks on LGBTQ folks, and particularly the transgender community. We saw the passage of the anti-trans sports ban that banned transgender girls and women from playing sports in accordance with their gender identity. And then last year we saw the passage of the what folks call the Don't Say Gay law, which we've challenged in federal court as well. But really over the last year, we have seen an unprecedented number of attacks from various sort of a multifaceted, multi-pronged attack on trans rights from the legislature and our administrative agencies. And what has happened in Florida has really been unprecedented in that the governor has utilized the rulemaking process and the folks that are that lead these agencies, like the Agency for Healthcare Administration, the Boards of Medicine, the Department of Education. Those are folks that are appointed and handpicked by the governor, and we can't vote them out of office if they do things that don't align with our values and beliefs as Floridians. And he's, you know, the state has utilized the rulemaking process to pass really insidious laws and bans targeting particularly access to gender-affirming health care for transgender folks, in addition to many other things. But it's very different than the way that they've done it in other states, because they've built this record using the rulemaking process, and then all of these terrible laws have been based upon that record that they built. But the most, I think, the things that have passed that folks are most aware of are the expansion of the Don't Say Gay, Don't Say LGBTQ law that bans teachers from using their pronouns and allows anyone to disrespect trans folks' affirmed pronouns. The ban on Medicaid coverage of gender-affirming care, which we were able to strike down through a federal lawsuit after a two-week trial. And the bans on access to gender-affirming care for minors through SB 254 and the Board of Medicine rules, as well as many restrictions on adults accessing health care, which, again, is unprecedented and not something that is happening in other states. And then we also have seen the bathroom ban and some really, really draconian rules and laws restricting what can and can't be discussed and taught in K through 12 schools, as well as in higher education.
The question I have for you is why? I guess why has there been an attack on a legislative attack, so to speak, on this community? Like, I guess maybe the better question isn't why, but what's the reasoning given for these laws?
Yeah, so I mean, this is just sort of feels like a moment out of a history book, right? I think we've all learned about the Johns Committee and how, you know, many, many years ago, Anita Bryant, that there was a whole push to sort of eradicate LGBTQ people in the state of Florida under the guise of protect the children, right? And whether we are looking at, you know, old sodomy laws or marriage equality or access to bathrooms, these are always perpetuated under the notion that somehow we as LGBTQ people, and particularly transgender folks, are somehow inherently dangerous or somehow inherently a threat to others. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. And when you actually look at all of the evidence and the data and the science, you know, the reality is the justifications that the state puts forward have no basis, and there is no justification for these. But just to break it down a little bit, you know, the sports bans and the bathroom bans and things like that are justified on the basis of, you know, protect children from losing in sports to people that might have a biological advantage, or protecting children in the bathrooms from being harmed or assaulted, when the truth is we know that transgender people are the ones that are statistically far more likely to be the victims of abuse and assault and things of that nature. There have been no instances of them perpetuating crimes on others or violating folks' privacy. When it comes to the healthcare bans, again, these are pushed as protect the children from experimental treatments, or, you know, they often use words like mutilation, and they're really trying to scare people about something that most people have very little knowledge and very little information about. And it's easy to weaponize fear about topics that people are unfamiliar with. And so when they talk about this healthcare as being experimental and harmful and child abuse, they are absolutely 100% misrepresenting the evidence and the science, because every major medical organization in our country has agreed that this care is medically necessary and can be life-saving. And in the cases that we've brought where we've actually been able to put on all of the evidence and all of the experts in this from across the country, the judges have come to the same conclusion, which is that these are politically motivated endeavors that are not at all based on science or evidence. And what I find even more insidious is the notion that they're pushing these things as protecting the children, but then when you look at the actual rules and laws themselves, they target adults as well.
Yeah.
They're taking away adults' ability to make healthcare decisions for themselves.
You can join the conversation. You can call in at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC on air. You can email us at firstcoastconnected@wjct.org. And you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. And actually, I'm going to go to the phones now. We have a caller. Hello, caller. How are you? And what's your name?
Eric in Arlington.
Eric, how are you this morning?
I'm fine. I hope you guys are all fine as well. So my question is, does the LGBT community realize that they are actually hurting the working poor? And what I mean by that is that, you know, the Democratic Party champions the LGBTQ community, and rightfully so. Someone, you know, needs to make sure that these people's rights are protected and so on. But they protect the LGBTQ community. They also champion the rights of the working poor, things like raising minimum wage, making sure universal health care, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a lot of members of the voting public that won't vote for the Democratic Party because of their relationship with the LGBTQ community.
Let me just clarify your position on this. You think the Democratic Party should not look out for disadvantaged or targeted communities just so they can make sure that they get the votes from poor people? Is that what you're trying to say? 'Cause I'm trying to understand.
Sure. Okay, sort of. Well, I guess what I'm
because
saying
I'm just
is that
I think that like what the Democratic Party like they have a basis of what they believe, and so I guess what I'm getting at here is that like you're asking the Democratic Party to pick and choose between groups of people that they represent instead of looking at it as a holistic approach where like this is what the Democratic Party represents and poor people as well as LGBTQIA people fall into it. And I would just say that like your parsing of these two different communities, there are a lot of poor people that are a part of the LGBTQIA community as well.
Well, I realize that this sounds sort of Machiavellian, sort of the ends justify the means, but there are, I mean, I would say probably, I don't know what the numbers are. They seem to go up all the time, but like 55% or 60% of Americans, myself included, who couldn't scrape together $500 if they needed to. That's a lot of people. That's 150 million people that are on the verge of, living behind Walmart. So I guess what I'm saying is I think that's a bigger fish to fry than the 1% or 2%. And I know it sounds like I'm devaluing what this community is doing. I'm not. I think that they have rights, and their rights should be protected. They should be able to feel safe. They should be able to have all the things.
My friend, I would just say that you are devaluing the community when you put it in those terms, that you are saying that the issues that you're going through, which I validate, like I understand.
150 million people.
Hold on. Let me finish. Let me finish. I'll let you talk. Let me finish. I hear what you're saying. And I recognize that poverty is an issue in this country, and I'm going to let my guests speak, but I would just say that you're putting the onus on them, like they're the reason why this country has issues and has huge poverty issues. And I would say that like the person that the the people that should be carrying that weight are not people that are struggling to make it themselves and also struggling for protections. When you frame the conversation the way you're currently framing it, you're putting the onus on the LGBTQIA community, and I don't think that's fair. But please, Jody, do you have any thoughts about this?
Well, I do agree. I think you made the point already, is that the working poor and the very poor, the intersectionality with the LGBTQ is very high, and the statistics show that they are targeted for being in both categories. So I think you're protecting one, you protect the other group. And
yeah, I think one of the things. Please go ahead.
I was just going to note that I completely understand the concerns of this caller, and I think that it's not pie. It's not that focusing on one issue takes away from another issue. I think we absolutely need to be addressing income inequality and poverty and LGBTQ rights. But I just want to note that the caller led with, the LGBTQ community is hurting the working poor. And I want to push back and provide information that I think very few people have, which is that this state, this government in the state of Florida, prior to even us filing the litigation challenging these anti-LGBTQ laws, particularly the gender-affirming care bans, this state had spent $1.3 million of taxpayer money bringing in experts and defending indefensible discriminatory bans on healthcare that people need to survive. So the state is wasting money that could otherwise be spent improving the lives of the people most in need in this state instead of bullying and targeting transgender children.
And we're going to go to the phones again, and you can join the conversation at 549-2937. We've got Lisa. Lisa, how are you this morning?
I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Obviously, since I live in Tallahassee, I have access to the Kaplan. So I attended a lot of sessions. And I can tell you the baseline on all this is using hate and ignorance as a distraction and to divine conquer. If you can poke at people's fears and the things that they don't understand and weaponize that, that is exactly what is happening here. They're picking on the most vulnerable people, already most vulnerable people in the state. That's what bullies do. And they have, like the your experts on the in the studio were talking about, they have weaponized the different agencies, Board of Education, the Department of Education, filling the DOE and the BOE with Moms for Liberty. And they just appointed another one, I think, yesterday. There was a representative in a House committee meeting that called the LGBT young people that are in the crowd demons and imps. And it was a Black man, of all people, to understand oppression and bigotry. And so there's a lot of the extreme religious component to this, and that is what they pandered to the entire session. They ignored data, they ignored experts, and they went to the zealots and the hate. That is divisive. It is very unhealthy for the state of Florida. When our kids are being taught not to tolerate each other, and they're being told that they can't talk about things, that's not education. It is just indoctrination. So I was there. I saw it. It's going to cripple our state. Our kids' education is being devalued, and they're going to come out of school with no capacity to get along with people that are different from them. Thank you.
Lisa, thanks so much. So, Jody and Simone, I want to ask you a little bit of a tricky question. When I'm having conversations out in the community about these laws, and I will just say that, like, you know, the community that I'm in, the community that I'm a part of, and the people that I see a lot, a high number of LGBTQIA folks. But sometimes when I'm talking to people, they will say things like, you know, don't agree with these laws, don't agree with all of this. Don't agree with the bathroom laws, but people will always point to the issue of athletes and kids competing against each other, and the idea that if a trans athlete, like a trans woman athlete, is competing in a woman's sport, that she has a biological advantage because, you know, she started life as a male. And so, like, how do you talk through those issues with people?
Well, I would say, just like every other anti-LGBTQ law that we have seen promulgated in recent years, it's a solution in search of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I should say it's a problem in search of a problem. But the reality is, cisgender girls and women, cisgender are folks whose sex assigned at birth and gender identity are aligned. Cisgender girls are not displacing, or I'm sorry, transgender girls are not displacing cisgender girls or taking opportunities away from them or in any way negatively impacting anyone. These are children who deserve the benefits that are conferred by being involved in sports. We know that team sports have a host of benefits for social, emotional, and physical development. And to deny people the opportunity to play sports and to develop all of those things solely out of fear, based on zero instances of any actual issues, but fear that they could possibly do XYZ, beat the other girls or get a scholarship opportunity or something, is just, it's absurd. And it's so sad, the amount of time and effort that our legislature and legislatures across the country spend talking about an issue that literally is not harming anyone, that is not a problem, when there are so many other issues impacting the folks in our communities that desperately need attention.
It feels like the reason why I bring it up is because it feels a little bit like it's something on the fringes that is used to distract from what the real issue is.
Absolutely. And the reality is, people really don't understand, you know, gender affirming healthcare or transgender existence. But when we give kids access to it with their parents and parental consent and it with their doctors, but when we give them access to medical care like puberty blockers, it completely alleviates the concerns that folks purport to have with things like sports, because when you block the secondary sex characteristic or secondary endogenous hormone production, the science shows that transgender girls have no biological advantage over cisgender girls, yet they're concerned about the biological advantage that testosterone might provide while simultaneously banning these children from accessing things like blockers and estrogen and things that they need to live healthy lives. So it's just incredibly hypocritical, and it's absolutely a distraction and a way to divide and get their base angry about something that they really just don't understand.
Jody, we have to wrap up soon, but before we go, I just wanted to get your response to this. The number one leading cause for death for children in the United States in teens, surpassing car accidents, is firearms, is gun violence. And I'm curious, like, knowing that statistic, and you hear this legislature talk about they are protecting kids, but they won't do anything about gun violence, but they are targeting the LGBTQIA community and saying that this is one of the biggest dangers to our children. Like, how do you respond to that? Like, that, because it just seems like to be such a huge disconnect.
It is. It's one of many disconnects. They certainly should be figuring out somehow to protect children and the communities from guns. They should be providing more mental health services, and they should be providing, more. A lot of this comes down to also teaching our kids. I think one of the callers was mentioning, you know, a good education from a young age, giving them all of the services they need, teaching them empathy. So guns is definitely a big part of it. But, part of the reason that kids are seeking guns as a solution is because we're just so disconnected, and, the education is terrible and the services in the community are terrible. And it's, there's not just a one answer, but they are wasting their time on a lot of things that aren't solutions. And, that's very unfortunate.
Jody Siegel, Executive Director of the Southern Legal Counsel, and Simone Chris, Director of the Transgender Rights Initiative at Southern Legal Counsel. We just barely touched the tip of the iceberg with this subject. I would love to have you on again and talk more about the work that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And we'll be back soon. Stay tuned. And you're listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in the big chair in Studio 2 at WJCT. So a Jacksonville-based nonprofit, Cold Case, is releasing a second edition of playing cards. Each card features a homicide victim whose case remains unsolved here in Florida. Here to tell us more about the cards and how you can help is Ryan Backman, founder and executive director of Project Cold Case. Ryan, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, sir?
I'm good. So tell me a little bit about how you created this card deck and how you got involved in all of this.
So to tell the whole story in a quick version, in 2009, my dad was murdered here in Jacksonville, Florida. He was working on a Saturday afternoon, middle of the day, but he was by himself at a newly renovated office building, and somebody came in, robbed him, shot him.
Wow.
And left. And that case is still unsolved. So I've lived this life, you know, for almost 14 years now. Next month will be 14 years. And you really start to feel like your loved one disappears and mm-hmm. people forget and nobody cares anymore. Everybody's kind of moved on. And I don't like that feeling. I don't like it for myself. And I don't like it for the other people that have unsolved cases, not just here, but across the country. And so in 2015, I started Project Cold Case with that goal and that foundation that we would provide a space for families so they knew their loved one was not forgotten and that somebody else cared. And that really was just the foundation of the organization. And since then, we've added a lot, including these decks of playing cards, which is an opportunity, obviously, that maybe somebody will see this story and come forward with information. But beyond that, we're creating value for these victims mm-hmm. and providing an opportunity for their story to be shared with people that don't know it.
Yeah. I as you were talking, I was thinking about some personal stuff. My best friend passed away soon. He passed away like almost a year ago. And dealing with his loss, with his death, has been like one of the hardest things I've had to deal with. But the thing that I think about a lot is that the world just keeps moving.
Yeah.
And he's gone. And and sometimes I just want to bang on the table, like, stop moving, pay attention. You know, like this man mattered. He died of cancer, and you can be mad at cancer all day and all of that. But I think it's gotta be a whole different thing when somebody takes that life and there's no justice. There's no, and of course, like the whole justice system, again, continues to move on,
right.
You know, and like, so you'll get like, I'm sure like it's intense, like the first month or two, you're feeling like people are checking in with you and so forth and so on. But then somebody else gets murdered and they move on to a different case. And then you're just feeling left behind and your loved one gets lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. It really is, you know, the days turn into weeks and weeks turn into months and months turn into years. And, you know, friends and family stop asking how you're doing. They yeah. stop asking. They stop bringing up your loved one's name. And I think, you know, loss and grief is, you know, I don't like to compare it because it's horrible for all of us yeah. when we experience it. But there are definitely layers of complexity when it's violence.
Yep.
When it's unsolved, when it's a child, you know, I mean, there's all of these other things that come into play that just add layers of complexity. And it's really hard to move through that alone. And I think that's, you know, what I want Project Cold Case to be. And what it's become is a place where those people, a safe place where those people can come. And it doesn't matter if it's been, you know, a year or 50 years.
Yeah.
If they're still struggling with it, we're here for them.
Yeah, because when you lose somebody through violence and you don't know what happened, the question of what happened and why, like I am sure that like it's one of those things that keeps you up at night, just trying to, because grief and all of that stuff will drag you down. But if you can wrap your head around it, like with my best friend, like I can wrap my head around that it was cancer.
Yeah.
I understand what it was. It doesn't give me comfort to know what it was, but at least like it's a struggle that I don't have.
Right.
But if it was violence and nobody knows exactly what happened, like I can just imagine how you're wondering who this person was that gave you such a grievous hurt. Why did this person do this? Will there ever be any justice? Like it just, I can imagine that makes the grief stick longer and harder because it's the big unknown.
Absolutely. And I appreciate your compassion and empathy and recognizing those things, because that is our struggle. And, you know, kind of like you said, the not knowing, I work with families that don't know how many times their loved one was shot, how many times their loved one was stabbed decades ago, because that information is still considered, you know, too important to the investigation.
Right.
To be shared with the family. And so when you're left with that situation, you create the scenario in your head.
Yep.
And that may be the worst place to be, without information and creating your own scenario.
Yeah. So I'm opening up the deck of cards here. And so on these cards, these are like playing. I did not expect these to be playing cards, but yeah. They're actually playing cards, right?
They're actually playing cards.
And in it, you've got color photographs of people who passed away through homicide. I'm reading one now. It's Philip Davenport. He passed away March 7th, 2013. And he passed away in Navarrete, Florida. I'm not going to read the card because I don't want to. I'm pretty sensitive to these things, and I don't want to trigger any bad things for any of our listeners here. But you've got a whole pack of people. You've even got one person here that is unidentified. Like there's an artist sketch of this person. Can you tell me a little bit about that one?
Yeah. So when we're, you know, we have 52 cards. We were able to identify 55 victims because we had a pair of sisters. We had a family of three. We put those on the same deck. So we had 55 victims on 52 cards, all from Florida. 11 of them are from Jacksonville. One's Jacksonville Beach, one's Ponte Vedra Beach, and then spread out throughout the rest of the state. But when we're selecting, which is a hard process, obviously, because everybody deserves to be on a card.
Absolutely.
Why we have a second edition and why we will continue to create editions as funding allows. But we want to show a very diverse range. We don't want all the same demographic, whether it's age, gender, race, or any of those things, geographic location. We want to show that. And as we were going through things, I realized this is another demographic that is kind of overlooked, and that's unidentified victims. Mm-hmm. And so we found one that we knew the investigating agency, and we knew the group that created the facial approximation, the computer-generated sketch, if you will, composite, if you will. And somebody out there doesn't know that they're supposed to be fighting for this victim, because maybe they think that she ran away and that she's, you know, had enough of her family and she just wanted to go start a life somewhere else. And that's not what happened. She was murdered somewhere. And so she deserves those answers just like the rest of these victims. And so she's the only unidentified one in this deck. But as we continue to do this, we grow and we evolve and we realize that we need to include them as we move forward.
We got to wrap up, but can you tell me how can people contribute or and help this cause?
You can go to our website, projectcoldcase.org. Businesses will give these to you, to businesses, particularly ones with waiting rooms and lobbies where people can be sitting around actually looking at these cards and reading these stories.
All right. Ryan Backman, founder and executive director of Project Cold Case. Ryan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson. The United States Holocaust Museum and the American Library Association teamed up to create the recently developed Americans and the Holocaust exhibition. The project was conceptualized using new research from that period of history. The Jacksonville Public Library is one of 50 locations chosen to receive the exhibit. Tammy Kiter, Special Collections Librarian at the Jacksonville Public Library, is here with more information. Tammy, how are you?
I'm nervous, but thank you for having me on today.
Come closer to the mic. Tammy told me this is her first time being on the radio.
That's true.
You're doing great.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So look, I love the library. The library is like my happy place. Plus, a good friend of mine who's a librarian there, I grew up with them, so...
Wonderful.
Yes, Laura so Bowles Minor.
Yes, yeah, of
Laura's
course.
My girl.
She's my manager.
Yes, I have known her since I was 12.
So we've sort of got the 6 degrees of Jacksonville Public Library happening.
Absolutely. So please tell me about this exhibit.
So we are incredibly honored to have this exhibit. And as you had mentioned, actually over 250 libraries applied to be a host location for the exhibit. And Jacksonville Public Library is among only 50.
Wow.
In the United States that was chosen. So we're really honored to have it. And we believe that part of the reason we were actually chosen is because our library has a Holocaust collection.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly published materials, biographies, autobiographies, scholarly journals, etc. We also have some oral histories available for Jacksonville residents who were Holocaust survivors. We did host a number of years ago another similar exhibit called Deadly Medicine, that was related to Nazi Germany's efforts to perfect a master race in their eyes. Mm-hmm. So that connection, I think, brought us closer to being selected to host it.
It feels like in the times that we are in, and maybe it's not just the times, maybe it's all the time, that there is a tax on history and a re-envisioning of what happened before. And so exhibits like this that, you know, really set the record straight and really talk to what actually happened, it just seems to me more important right now than maybe it's been in a long time.
Absolutely. I think it's bringing things sort of full circle for us. And what's really unique about this exhibit is that they're not just focusing on the past. Obviously, we all need a history lesson. We truly do. A lot of things have been covered over. And, you know, censorship was involved in media's representation of what was happening as well. But we have to recognize that issues from 80 years ago are still prevalent today. Human rights issues, civil rights issues, racism, immigration issues, segregation issues. These are all relevant today, just as they were then. And this exhibit really focuses on two questions they're trying to answer in relation to the Holocaust itself. The first is, what did Americans know? And the second question is, what more could we have done? And I think that those questions could be asked of all of us today as well.
Yeah. In the exhibit, like, what did Americans know during the time when Hitler was rising to power and putting the Jewish people in concentration camps? My understanding is that the Americans really didn't know a whole lot until, like, after the war.
We did know some. Americans did know some of what was going on, but we really have to take into consideration that media at that point was certainly not what it is today.
Sure.
Most people were getting their news from newspapers, also radio, but then also people who were living in Europe at the time and being impacted by these events on a very personal level. If they were able to write home and communicate with family members and friends, that was another really good way to find out about what was happening on a very personal level, not just through media, where today we're bombarded with multiple formats of media, and it's up to us to actually process what is legitimate news and then how to process that information and how to move forward from it. But we were able to, United States Holocaust Memorial Museum was able to conduct a program where they actually did research in newspapers across the country, from the tiniest local community newspaper up to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and really uncover the coverage, the footage that was happening of that, the events that were unfolding during World War II and even prior to the United States participation in World War II. And to really, some of it, and it's the distinction between things that were covered as world news, just, you know, world news coverage versus the really personal things. For instance, I've done research in the Florida Times Union, which we have on microfilm at the library dating back to 1882, and very much community-centered articles that are talking about interfaith events happening at Catholic churches and Christian churches, not just at synagogues, that are really bringing people together to try to collect money and clothing and food donations, but also to really develop these community ties that branch out beyond anyone's faith, but just in humanity. And those articles date back to the 30s.
Wow. Wow. So tell me, where can my audience go to see this, and how long is it going?
Okay. So the exhibit officially opened yesterday. We had an opening reception last night that went very well during Art Walk. The exhibit covers 1,100 square feet on the fourth floor of the main library. It's just in the atrium outside of Special Collections. It will run from September 6th to October 12th. We also have some incredible public programming happening during the exhibit. We have film screenings. We have panel discussions with members of nonprofit cultural organizations here in Jacksonville. And that discussion is called Resisting Hate, Repairing the World. That will actually wrap up our exhibit and hopefully continue this dialogue. We have Q&As with second and third generation Holocaust survivors. If people need more information, they can go to the library's website at jaxpubliclibrary.org, or you can call 255-BOOK.
All right. Tammy Kiter, Special Collections Librarian at the Jacksonville Public Library. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
You did great on your first radio interview.
I appreciate your kindness. And please come see the exhibit.
I will. And we'll be right back.
Congarean Pin, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpin.com. Amelia Island presents the Amelia Island Dance Festival, September 8th to 10th, with events celebrating a variety of dance genres, plus workshops designed to inspire dancers of all levels. Info at ameliaisland.com/AIDF.
On the next Fresh Air, Grammy and Oscar-winning music producer Mark Ronson. He's known for his party hits, pop songs, and soulful arrangements, producing for stars like Amy Winehouse, Lady Gaga, and Adele. His latest project is Barbie the Album, the soundtrack for the fantasy comedy film Barbie, directed by Greta Gerwig. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Scott Tong. A new documentary, Billion Dollar Heist, tells the true story of cyber hacking and bank theft. We talked to the narrator about how vulnerable the online world is.
What do you do to make the internet safe? You dismantle the whole thing and you reimagine it from the beginning.
That's next time and Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
It's been 15 months since the end of Roe v. Wade. In the aftermath, there's a dizzying range of new laws across the country. 15 states have banned the procedure, and recently some conservative groups in states like Idaho and Texas have pushed to prevent people from leaving the state for care. We get into states' rights and health care next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Listen. Y'all, I don't even have any words because the puns have gone to a whole nother level. They've, like, David Luckin has brought the puns to a whole nother level because in the studio right now with me, I have my man, my mellow, Mr. Al Pete.
My man, my mellow Al Letson. How you feeling, sir?
I'm good, man. Al Pete and Al Letson, all the Al's
all
you could
Al's
ever
in
want.
The house. Call us Al. I love it.
Hey, Al, if you be my bodyguard.
I will be your long lost pal.
Hey, I could call you Betty.
You just call me Al.
I will. So, month-long Sing Out Loud Festival kicks off this week, and Jacksonville Music Experience is getting in on the action with the 904 Soul Showcase. All local showcase, which will feature some of Duval's best R&B and soul artists. The 904 Soul Showcase kicks off at 7 p.m. on Saturday this September at Dog Rose Brewing in historic St. Augustine, and it's free to attend. The lineup was curated by none other than the, I won't say the other Al, I'll just say by Al Pete, Mr. Al Pete.
Yes, sir.
Because,
yes,
you know, I mean, the world's big enough for two Al's.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
So, Mr. Pete, please tell me, who do you have performing?
So, first off, we have Ebonique. Ebonique, she's been buzzing around town for a couple of years now. Her latest single, Respectfully, is new. So, she's working on some new stuff. She's always been a gem on my end. We have Kirsten Moyer, my apologies on that. So we have her. And we have Broadway Louie. So Broadway Louie is, you know, a hip-hop artist, but at the same time, too, he's been touching the soul aspect of on his last project, Magic. And then we have DJ Larry Love bringing the funk, Mr. R&B mostly himself.
Okay. So now I know Ebonique's music. Loved her first, I think it was an EP.
Edge Control.
Loved that one. Not familiar with Kirsten and Broadway Louie. Tell me a little bit more about them.
So Kirsten, I'm still getting implemented with her, but I have her album Flutters. It was brought to my attention over the summer, and she just has like this sound. It's this very heroic sound of soul, and it really caught my attention on first go around. So as far as knowing her as an artist, I'm going to be getting a glimpse of her for the first time, seeing her perform on Saturday. But just her music is just a good definition of Duval. So
yeah, you know what? Like, I actually have been listening to some. I now that I looked it up as you were talking, I was like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, I know her. She's dope. Tell me about Broadway Louie.
So Broadway Louie, he's been around for a good minute as well. Hip hop artist, taps into the soul range often, but his last album Magic definitely touches on that, and it's very, very interesting to hear him on this level. He's always he's an actor as well, so he's in all kind of lanes. So for him to be in this soul bag, on this last album that he released. I'm just ready to see him actually perform it and just give the energy to the people.
Okay, is this him we're listening to right now?
Yeah, Looking. Okay. Yeah, this is the Looking joint. This is the one that, me personally, I always play.
So, all right.
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me hear a couple bars of that.
We should link again. I'm on the brink again. With you on my mind, I can't think again.
It has this... It has a summer vibe, you know what I'm saying? But it's a vibe that can carry on throughout the season.
Yeah. Okay. And I breezed past Ebonique, but let's dive in because, like, I love her music. Please, mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about Ebonique.
Oh, man, Ebonique just has, like, this defining soul of her. She definitely has the R&B voice, the great singing voice, and it's just rich. And it's very prominent when you hear it and listen to the words that she speaks and as she sings.
Yo, I've been a little distant, hey. And a lot of my combos have shortened. But I've been working on my healing. Cause my purpose is way more important.
Yeah, this is my jam.
Yeah. So I'm ready for her to come out with a new album, but this song, Respectfully, definitely makes her stand out and, like, you know, I'm here, and it seals the Duval Soul for me.
Yeah.
She's one of those leaders of the Duval Soul, for sure.
So talk to me about the 904 Soul Night. Like, when is it? Where is it? And do people need to get tickets? Like, how's that work?
Oh, no, it's free 99. I know people love free 99.
I love free 99.
Yeah, so
free 99 is my favorite price for everything. I'm gonna go to lunch after this and be like, can I get a free 99?
Depending on where you go at, you might get it.
Maybe.
Yeah, so it's gonna be a Dog Rose Brewery down in St. Augustine's, part of the Sing Out Loud Festival. Shouts out to the crew there for allowing me and JME Jacksonville Music Experience to put that on. So show starts at 7, ends at 11. It's gonna be great, man.
All right, so Jacksonville, you heard it here. Go check out all of these beautiful soul artists, and Mr. Al Pete will be in the house.
Yeah,
it's always a good thing to see Mr. Al Pete.
Yeah, man, I'm thankful for the opportunity, for sure, to showcase the show music.
All right,
the soul music.
And that is our show today. Thank you for all of our guests coming in, especially Al P. I was going to say the other Al, but that just doesn't feel right. I'm not going to do that to you. Our executive producer is Music Maestro David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey the Brain Bennett. Our director, the Steven Spielberg of the operation, is Brady Corum. Our music was provided by Club De Belugas. If you have questions or comments, hook it up at firstcoastconnected@wjct.org. I'm Al Letson. You've been listening to the show here on 89.9 News. Remember, y'all, keep your heart open for Duval and each other. And I'll be back tomorrow with the Media Roundtable.
Just for my attention, you say that you're the one, you gon' have to show
you
me.
You say that you
just
would.
Just to be the fun, that gon' be with
no,
me.
I'm
and I know
everyone
don't deserve to know me.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.